Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, principal teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Mind Training. Santa Fe Retreat, Part 6.
Lovely, yes. That's the symptom of a long habituation of walking without attention. Others. Elizabeth. Say a bit more about that, please. Speak up a bit over the fans. Jean. I'll sneak up on you and then you're sitting. You're. Shauna. Yeah, walking meditation is great for trying to get somewhere, isn't it? I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there. Any other comments? Janaki. A little easier to send when you're walking. Interesting. Well, yes, Beth. Kind of like life, isn't it? Jen. While I was watching you, you're doing fine. Okay. Well, you're quite right.
not really. And I noticed that a group energy or group rhythm evolved, and most people were walking in that. But even if the person in front of you is walking one way, still stay with your own breath, so that you may be taking shorter steps, but it is actually in time with your own breath, rather than adopting the rhythm of the person in front of you. That's fairly important. One of the reasons I wanted to get your feedback is that you're thinking, I was thinking, of doing the middle of the session of the evening meditation as walking meditation, and wondered how that would be. Am I hearing yeses? Okay, well, that fixes that. That's what we'll do. Yes, Pat? Yes, I want you to do the taking and sending form of walking meditation. Now, as one person observed, you can, if that really slow walking is difficult, and it is difficult for some people, then walk at a natural pace and just do taking and sending as you're walking at a more natural pace, and that's okay to do. But I would definitely want you to continue the practice of taking and sending into the walking. Don't you get too far away. You want to use the sun porch. There's a couple of people here, and walk around outside as Sari was, because around that circle. That's going to take a little of the congestion off. But during the, I'd like to keep it relatively contained. We can't walk on the grass, otherwise we could just go out and define a large area. Yes, Deborah? Yes, but then we're going to be walking in a line, and that brings up a whole number of other things. Yes, Mark? Pardon? Oh, yes, I noticed that probably some people going back and forth in front of the shrine, and that's fine also. So I want it to be as loose as it can be in the structure that we have available, so everybody can find their own rhythm. Yes, Franca? I will make sure I keep the irritation in for you. Thistles under your feet. Alicia. Yes, please, go ahead. Yeah. So I'll work out the timings with Janaki, and that's what we'll do for the evening meditation. The middle section. This afternoon, we turn to the sixth of the 7 points, and that is commitments. Now, the term commitment is a strange term in a Mahayana context. The Tibetan is dantsik, a word which means literally holy word. It can also mean pledged word, and have either of those meanings. So it basically means a promise. And the Sanskrit, for those of you who are familiar with it, is samaya. And usually this is an exclusively a Vajrayana term. In particular, it defines an important aspect of one's relationship with one's teacher. So Chaikawa's use of it here, I was thinking about this. It's unusual. It's not a standard Mahayana term. It's much stronger than the standard Mahayana term would be, which would be, I'm not sure what it would be in Tibetan, but more like responsibilities. Now, in the Tibetan, the whole 7 points of mind training is written actually quite informal Tibetan. So I have the feeling that Chaikawa wrote this either for his own edification or for one of his students. And he used this term commitment to give the idea, this is stuff you've got to do. So it's much stronger than point number 7, which are guidelines. Always train in the three basic principles. And again, if anybody has suggestions about the English, I'm always open to suggestions. The term is very vague in Tibetan, and I just had to make up some kind of English word for it. The three basic principles are observing any of the vows that you have taken. That's number one. Number two is behaving appropriately. And number three is covering all aspects of practice. Let me explain each of these a little bit. In the Tibetan tradition, there were three ordinations or three sets of vows you could take. One was the ethical code for individual liberation, which concerned specific actions such as not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to have inappropriate sexual relations, not to take intoxicants. Those are the basic five precepts. These were elaborated in full monk ordination to some 256. All kinds of, many of them having to do with how you behaved in front of other people and particularly how you interacted within the Sangha. Then you had the Bodhisattva vow, which is not about specific actions, but about maintaining a certain attitude. And I'll be going into that in more detail in a couple of days. And then you had the Vajrayana vow, which one takes when you take any of the higher empowerments, which much harder. And that is not just refraining from certain actions or maintaining a certain attitude, but experiencing the world a certain way. That's the actual Vajrayana vow. Very hard. Atisha was once asked, how have you been doing with your ordinations? He said, oh, the monastic ordination I've never broken. The Bodhisattva, all about every 2 hours. Vajrayana ordination, violations are like a rain shower. In terms of the way that we, most of us, practice here in the West, which is within that framework, but not as deeply committed formally undertaken as tended to be in Tibet and India. This first principle is, if you say you're going to do something, you do it. Now, if you say you're going to stop that kind of action, you do it. That's it. You don't. So it's really meaning what you say. The second principle is basically about not showing off. People would practice and they think they had some kind of realization, and to show that they were free of social constraints, they would do outrageous things. We've had a little history of that here in the West too. And from the mind training point of view, to do outrageous things, to say outrageous things, to appear outrageous, in order to impress people with your understanding, is totally against the spirit of mind training, which is to undo attachment to a self-image. So showing off is the very antithesis of that. Then the third principle, usually phrased in the negative, you know, don't be partial in your practice. And as Confl writes in here, some people are really good at getting along with other people, but they have no patience when they get ill. And other people are the other way around. They can bear illness very easily, and patiently and very constructively, but they really don't get along with anybody. And maybe you can do those things, but somewhere else you're falling down. As it says elsewhere in the book, it's very important for mind training to touch every aspect of your experience. Another way that I put this is don't protect any area of your life from your practice. The area of life that you protect from your practice is reinforced. Two things happen. When you protect an area of life from your practice and you continue to practice, because you practice, the general level of energy in the system increases. Because that's what practice does. It raises the level of energy because you're cultivating attention. So energy pours into that area that you're not paying attention to, and it pours into the blocking mechanism. Both of those get stronger. So that area of your life gets more and more walled off from your conscious attention and operates more and more strongly. The result is various forms of imbalance. And we have seen this time and time again, various teachers who can be very, very capable in giving instruction and guiding people in certain contexts, but you put them in another context and their desire for sex, money, fame, power, or whatever is just right out of control. Or and the way that you see this is that when you interact with a person, if you hit an area where they are rigid or inflexible, that is an area that they're protecting from their practice. It's a good rule of thumb to have in mind. So one of the suggestions, just to slight diversion here, but something I wanted to say this evening. From my perspective, this is a very special group. The quality of practice is very solid. And I was noting that again in the walking meditation. So, for the record, you're doing very well. And for the record, don't let it go to your head. But it's very solid here. And because of that, I want to push you a little bit further. Just as I said this morning, I'm going to raise the bar. Didn't I seduce you into that nicely?
Okay.
Okay, now, some of you have been working with some quite personal issues, and appropriately so, that are coming up in the taking and sending, and that is very important. At the same time, this third principle of making sure all bases are covered is also very important. Now, in a question that came up, I think, yesterday, I sketched out a framework of practice that I used in my own practice of taking and sending. Now, going through the eight hot hells and the eight cold hells and the four kinds of hungry ghosts and the different kinds of animals and the four major and four minor suffering of the human beings and the suffering of the Titan realm and all the different problems in the gods realm and the different types of gods, etc., etc. That's one possible framework. Now, from our perspective, all of those, that whole Buddhist cosmology represents the total possible mind states that any of us could experience, might experience in our lives. So by meditating on every one of those explicitly, you're actually covering the whole range. And that's a very traditional method of doing so. I have a prayer with me, which Jemkin Kontra wrote, called the Mind Training Prayer. It's never been translated into English that I know of. And he just goes through every conceivable emotion. You know, he goes through the six realms, and then he goes through the five afflictions, and then he goes through the, I can't remember all of the other things, but one category after another. So if you know these categories, and Buddhism is a tradition of lists, as some of you know, they're very useful because they give you a framework. And if you're interested, I can sketch out, you know, the eight hot hells. That's about hot anger, you know, explosive kind. The cold hells are about hatred, that cold anger which freezes you inside. And then the hungry ghosts and I detail this in Wake Up to Your Life, the various kinds of obscurations where you look and you just, you never see that there's enough in the world, and it brings up all kinds of greed. But there's another kind of obscuration, is you have everything you need right around you, but nothing satisfies. And that's also represented in the hungry ghost realm. And in the human realm, the four major sufferings are birth, old age, illness, and death. The four minor sufferings are being with people you don't want to be with, not being with people you do want to be with, trying to get what you don't have, trying to keep what you do have. I remember working with a student in Southern California, and I presented these, because he was doing this meditation on the six realms. He looked at those, he spent just those four, he said, "That's what I spend my life doing." And these are the four sufferings of the human realm. And so I can go into that if anybody's interested, but you can use another framework. One that I thought of in preparing for this evening's talk is go through every socioeconomic status that you can think of, right from a homeless person on the street to Bill Gates or, the corporate executive elite and so forth. And just go through every one. You're going to cover all the bases that way. And some of you may think of other frameworks, but what I want to encourage you to do now is to come up with a framework which is going to cover the whole range of human experience and start working through that systematically in your meditation. Deborah. No, not really. The six reactive emotions cover most, and that's just the six realms. Okay, but really getting into all of the different, different kinds of desire and different kinds of pride, different kinds of jealousy. But some framework so that you cover the whole range of experience that you're ever likely to encounter in yourself. This is a way of not protecting any area of your life from your practice. Janaki. Yes? You can start at the bottom and work up. You can start at the top and work down. Well, that depends. We have 8 meditation periods in the day. So take 6 of them and put 1 on each realm. Or put 5 minutes on each realm in each session. Either way is fine. And some people work better shifting the focus of the practice fairly frequently because it keeps them awake and engaged in the practice. Other people do better taking one topic and really going into it deeply. And that's individual variation. There isn't a right or wrong there. So find the way that works with you. But what I want to emphasize now is developing a method of practice for yourselves, and I can help you with this in the interviews if you wish, which ensures that you cover the whole range of human experience. Okay, any questions about that? You're not protecting any part of your life from your practice. No. Because, for instance, if you think, I'm willing to do taking and sending with every aspect except control. I like to have control of my life. So I'm not going to give away control and I'm not going to take lack of control. Okay? That's what I mean about protecting an area of practice. And God's realms is a lot about control. Franca. Before hungry ghosts, and then there's the occasional, the neighboring health, and then the occasional health, yeah. Well, start by working through the six realms systematically. Just start by doing that. And as you work into anger, which is what the hell realm is about, then naturally you're going to start coming up with different kinds of anger. And so spend some time with, that I'm just going to tear this place apart kind of anger. And then you can spend some, you just gave me an idea too. And then you can spend some time with that, I'm going to sit here and boil. Used to be a cartoon strip in L.A. Called the Angry Dog or the Mad Dog. And just every cartoon is just this. It was a four frame cartoon strip, and everyone just showed this really angry dog. Week after week after week, it never changed. Just the minor variations in the seats. That's right. Is it dog
day
so
and night.
Day and night? Yeah, and it was dog so mad it wouldn't bark. Right. But it's just all the same. And then there's the cold anger, just like, and you can feel how it freezes you inside. That's what the cold pulses are about. And so you use these frameworks to open to all the different things that you experience in each of these realms. Okay? Yes, words of my perfect teacher, dual moments of liberation. If you really want to go it in gory detail, Tsongkhapa's the great stages of the path, which is a huge text, and so forth. But there's plenty of stuff in English. No. So just work with the six realms.
It's a very good library.
Is it a very good library here?
Yeah, and
it
connects.
Oh, okay.
Well,
right. The other four? Yeah, the six realms, page 64? Okay. Yes, there they are. Page 64, footnote 53. Now, for those of you who want to make this a little bit richer and are familiar with the five elements, you do the six realms crossed with the five elements. That'll give you 30 different things to work on. And if that's not enough, then you can take the four ways of working. That gives you 120 combinations. And if that's not enough, then you can do that in the the receptive and expressive forms of each of those. That gives you 240. If you need more than that, let me know. That's your homework, Pat, because I know you know all of those. And I'll get there first. Yes, you've been reading ahead there, bro. Okay. Second point. Change your attitude and stay natural. This is a wonderful line. The idea here is you don't let anybody know what you're working on. Now, those of you who've been around Dharma centers, you know the disease. I'm going to be so compassionate, I'll let you be generous first. Yeah. And this kind of nonsense. Haven't you heard that line? Pardon? You don't make, you don't go around saying, well, I don't think that's very fair, but because I'm practicing mind training, I'll go along with it. No, this is nonsense. This is making it about yourself and your self-image. Don't tell anybody what you're working on. And work on it very, very hard. Work on changing this attitude inside, so that you really are open to the suffering of others and giving away your own, whatever you value and enjoy. Remember the phrase that we've been working with somewhat, give away all victory and gain to others, take all loss and defeat for yourself. You defeat this entirely, you defeat the purpose of that entirely. You say, well, I'm going to lose because I'm working on mind training. It doesn't work at all. What's important, when you accept loss and defeat, you accept the humiliation, you accept the other person, exulting over the fact they won the argument, or if you're playing a game with them, they won that, things like that. And you can feel how attached you are to winning or being the best or whatever. And by experiencing all of that, you're undoing your attachment to that self-image. How many of you play some kind of competitive sport? Okay? I have an exercise for you. Lose intentionally. Doing one-on-one basketball? Lose. You're playing tennis? Lose. And do it totally intentionally. Amazing how hard it is. One person I worked with, took him 6 months before he could lose a game on one-on-one with his son. couldn't bring himself to do it. Why would you want to learn to lose? It means you're freed from the tyranny of having to win. I was playing tennis a year or two ago, and it was a pickup game at the local court, and the guy I was playing was so good, and I could hit my best shot, and he could put it away from wherever it landed in the court. Couldn't believe it. And he did it so effortlessly. And I just couldn't get to the ball. So after we'd done, you know, rallied for about half an hour, 40 minutes, something like that, and, well, should we play a set? Sure, we play a set. You know what the score was? 6-love for me. He didn't care about winning at all. He was totally into the activity of the stroke. And it's like, what's going on here? This guy could wipe me off the court. Just, shoo. That was a great experience. Okay. You stay natural. You know, you just behave as everybody else. You know, you don't make a big deal of it. Just go along with what's going on. But you're working at this transformation inside. And it's going to show up in your behavior, but not in any way that anybody's going to notice. Nobody notices when you lose. They think they won. Very reliable. Don't talk about failings. This is the idea here is, when you talk about failings, you're developing a critical attitude, judgmental attitude. When you see someone and they're obviously doing something wrong in their lives, or they have a serious problem, what is the taking and sending approach? Yes, you take it in and you give them yours. And you can't really do that if you're sitting off. No, so-and-so did that. And, you know, that was kind of stupid. So what you, anything that you see, anything that you experience, you immediately take as fuel for your practice. Don't make it something solid by talking about it. Follow? Yes, Judy. What are they? Quite correct. So how do you address this in the context of taking and sending? Very good question. No, as I recall, you didn't say a word. I could just feel something was brewing there.
Well, it's kind of obvious.
Yes. Exactly. And that, in what you say, is very valid. It's exactly the kind of thing that can happen. And why does that happen? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this is where taking and sending gets juicy, because if you're building up resentment, this is not doing you any good. And in relationship, if a relationship moves out of balance, the person who's putting more energy into the relationship than they're receiving experiences resentment, right? What does this person experience? Not usually. That's close. The way I put it is disdain. Okay? They lose their respect for this person, right? And that's the symptom that smooths out of balance. It's working for them, but they don't respect this person. Okay. So how do you move it back into balance? You don't do it by pointing out their failings. You do it by describing your own experience. When you do this, I experience this. And you can stand in your own experience without telling the other person that they have done anything wrong by just describing your own experience. You follow? That's how you rebalance. But you have to be willing to describe your own experience. You have to be willing to own your own experience and then describe it. Guy? There are two things going. If you're in a relationship with someone, and it can be a business relationship, it can be a work relationship, you can be working on a project together, you know, something that you're both enthusiastic about, it can be an intimate relationship. If one person is putting more into the relationship than they're receiving, more, and the other person is receiving more than they're putting in, and that persists, the relationship moves out of balance, and relationships cannot endure if they are out of balance for long periods of time, because the resentment and disdain build up. So, if you value the relationship, then you will move to rebalance it. But you move to rebalance it by describing your experience in the relationship. Now, the other person may listen to that and say, I don't care. Well, what does that tell you? Yeah, the relationship you thought existed doesn't. So now you've stepped out of an illusion, which can be very painful. I don't want to overlook that. Or the other person listens and says, oh, yeah, okay. And that starts the readjustment. But you've done this without laying, in what we were talking about earlier, without saying, you're to blame for this. You're just describing your own experience. Very important. Franken. It's very, yeah. That's right. Yeah. And that's exactly right. Because if you haven't really taken in what you're feeling, experienced it fully, then that projection goes on to the situation and creates further problems. And you're quite right, many people do interpret these as being a doormat, and then build up tremendous resentment, not only about relationships, but about the Dharma, because they just feel like they're being pushed down and down and down. Yes, Janaki. I would hesitate to call it compassion because that's a very slippery slope in my experience. I think you're going to be in better shape if you say, if you value the relationship, you're going to move to restore it to balance. And so the feedback you're giving the other person about your own experience in the relationship is an expression of your value of the relationship. You're saying, I want this relationship. But right now, it's not working for me because this is what I'm experiencing.
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.